I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome, everybody, to Spark My Muse. Today, my show is featuring Dr. Todd McGowan. He is an associate professor of film studies at the University of Vermont, and he is also the author of several books. One of them is Enjoying What You Don't Have, The Political Project of Psychoanalysis, The Impossible David Lynch, and the book we're going to be talking about today is called Capitalism and Desire, The Psychic Cost of Free Markets. Thank you so much, Todd, for being my guest today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
I was recommended your work by Peter Rollins, and I was recently doing his course called Atheism for Lent, and we encounter a lot of different philosophers and writers, and it's a critique of Christianity, and we read Marx and Feuerbach and all kinds of different writers, and as we were talking about satisfaction and desire and lack, he threw out, "Oh, Todd McGowan's book, Capitalism and Desire. Read that book." And I was like, "Ooh!" And so I picked it up, and I contacted you, and you sent it my way, and I have been reading it, and I thought this would be a really great way to introduce some of these concepts to my audience that are often, you know, we swim in capitalism, and at least in the United States and in many other Western affluent countries, we don't really realize this kind of overarching, overreaching system of commerce that we're involved with, and just how much it actually affects how we see the world and how we feel, and this toll it takes on us. We're just,
right.
We don't even realize there's another way, really, unless we've experienced living in a third world country or something, a dictatorship or something.
Well, I don't think a third world country is outside of the capitalist world, actually. Yeah. I mean, I think since the fall of not that the Soviet Union was a great alternative, but since the fall of that, I think that what you said is exactly right. There's no sense of another way.
Yeah, there's a globalism that puts its tentacles into every corner of the world, really.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so it would be great to unpack some of these ideas from your book, but I also love to get a context for the author, and it would be great to know, were you raised in the New England region, or what was your upbringing and some of your major influences?
Yeah, sure. It's a little tedious, but
whatever you want to share.
Right. I was born in the Midwest. I was born in Ohio, and my parents were fundamentalist Christians. So I was sort of scarred by that as a kid. But I luckily had a minister when I was in high school who gave me a book by Kierkegaard, and then he said, you know, you should really read this. And then I kind of got into it, and I kind of got into existentialism, and that sort of propelled me into graduate school. So that was, it's sort of, existentialism was sort of the basis for everything I did. And then I sort of discovered, I guess I would say Slavoj Žižek was a big influence. So I discovered him, and then like psychoanalysis became important. And that's important for this book, and it became important for me. So that kind of, and then sort of Marxism, sort of all those three kind of married together.
Mm. And it's an interesting intersection, because you take film and you relate it to some of those things. Can you, what you do now, how do those things interplay?
Well, I mean, I'm a film professor, so I have to teach, unfortunately, I have to teach classes on film. I can't just teach classes on theory. So I often my examples are filmic, and I sort of see how, you know, film both, you know, exemplifies certain aspects of capitalist, you know, capitalist fantasies, I guess, but also how it can present challenges to that, and sort of show us the way in which capital is operating and sort of working on us in ways that we otherwise wouldn't be aware of. So I think a lot of times people are aware when they're, you know, can become aware of things when they're watching a film that they otherwise couldn't, you know, wouldn't be aware of. I mean, that's true for me, I know.
Hmm. Well, what's an example of one of those films?
Yeah, that's a good, I figured you would ask that. I think, interestingly enough, I think I was just, you know, talking about, I was giving a talk the other day on Citizen Kane, and I feel like that's maybe the greatest film of all time. And to me, that's the one that really nicely shows how the relationship between, I think I talk about it in that book, about the relationship between, you know, like our desire and the way that capitalism sort of works, builds itself on that desire. So I think, you know, almost any film by Orson Welles, certainly Hitchcock's films, I think, you know, so there, but, you know, I think there are even contemporary popular films that are working in that direction, like Fight Club or, I don't know, something more. I certainly probably not The Fate of the Furious, which just opened. maybe. I don't know. I haven't seen it, so I shouldn't condemn. But.
Hmm. And so if we're peeling back the layers and just distilling, what do you mean by capitalism? What should the reader expect to understand?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think a lot of times it's a kind of a term that gets sort of bandied about, and then it doesn't really have a definite, you know, meaning attached to it. But for me, it's just the and I think this is sort of accepted definition, that it's the idea that what is dominant in the system is the free market, is exchange as more or less unregulated. Although the problem is that it always has some kind of state, sort of regulation or apparatus that's supporting it. But the notion that of the free market as a dominant, I think that's how I would see it. That's how I would define capitalism.
Yeah, in your book, you were talking about that the defenders of capitalism, you know, some of the prominent ideas about capitalism is sort of like it's neutral, it's in the background, and you know what could be so bad? We're just you know, trading, we're just, you know, exchanging goods. It's just transactional, and it's free. You know, it gives everybody an opportunity to make a buck. But in a sense, well, not even in a sense, there is an illusion of freedom because there are constraints, and especially it's because there are demands of the market. You can't just sell anything because not everything will sell. And there are, of course, government constraints, and you can't, you know, like you said, you can't sell nuclear bombs at the Walmart or whatever.
Right.
So some of those things are fantasy. And so there's a lot of fantasies playing into this model, but not just that, but one of the most interesting points is that the reason why capitalism persists for so long and is so powerful and such a powerful force and just kind of takes over wherever it goes is that you're promised satisfaction and it sort of never runs out of fuel because it delivers need in it.
Right. I mean, that's sort of my main point, is that actually the appeal of capitalism lies in the dissatisfaction that it delivers rather than the satisfaction. That is, that it gives us this constant promise of we're going to get the ultimate satisfying object or satisfying accumulation of whatever. And it never delivers on that promise. And the failure to deliver on the promise paradoxically invests us even more in trying to have the promise be fulfilled. So that's, I think, I think most people that are critical of capitalism are attacking it for not really satisfying us. But I want to say that that's actually why it's appealing, is that it doesn't really satisfy us. But there's a kind of satisfaction in that failure. And I think that's what we're not always aware of.
Hmm. Yeah. Can you talk just a little bit more about that, or maybe give an example too?
Yeah, sure. So I think the idea, so, you know, a lot of people are would say, oh, look, people like habitually buy, say these people that habitually buy new cars, right? Like every year they buy new cars, you know, would that they had, that people had enough money to do that. But there are people that do that. And so it seems like there's something like, and I think they themselves are caught up in this idea of like the car, it's not sad. Once I have it for a year, it's no longer, there's something dissatisfying about it. But my point is that it's actually that capitalism does provide a kind of satisfaction through this repetitive buying of the new, seeking out of the new thing and buying it and then being dissatisfied by it. And it's that cycle, which is actually the cycle of our desire. So that's, I mean, my main point in the book is that capitalism seems natural because it writes itself on the top of the way that we desire as subjects.
And there's also this component of the other and what we assume the other would approve of. And that's going to take a little bit of time to unpack because some people don't know what we mean by the other in psychoanalysis. But that is such a brilliant point that the other doesn't exist. That's a fantasy. And you know, when you can, I don't know if it's anti-venom or anything, but if it could be, oh my goodness, this would save a lot of angst, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And I look at like the Coachella festival and everybody's like looking like they're in a dress code at this music festival. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is like the capitalist music festival. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But you know, everybody's trying to have fun, but everybody's looking at everybody else going, do they like what I'm wearing? And everybody's kind of like in this, I mean, it's like, it's a hall of mirrors that is like this, like capitalist music festival where all these, you know, Verizon's sponsoring this and it's a riot. It's like, does anybody want to hear any good music?
Right. No, I know. Everything gets subsumed to that, I think. So the other is just, I like to think of the other as sort of anonymous social authority, which isn't like authority, like in the sense of somebody official, but just like the authority that people look to. I mean, what's interesting, I think, is it's much more evident in high school, you know, because it's clear like who the popular kids are and how they decide, like they're functioning as the other. They decide what's cool to wear, how it's cool to talk, whether it's cool to get good grades or cool to be in sports or what, you know. So, but I think what's true is that becomes not, what's interesting is it becomes less visible after we're out of high school, but it becomes almost, I would argue, even more powerful, like your example of the music festival. But, you know, even like the like what car I want to drive, like in Vermont, it's sort of requisite to drive a Prius, you know, like the, you know, or, you know, how, again, like how I'm going to dress, the things I'm going to eat. And that I think the other is driving us is that one of the main engines of consumption. That's for sure. Because all those things that allow us to feel recognized are things that are, that, you know, are attached to consumption. We have to buy them.
Well, maybe you can help me understand this part, because although the other, it doesn't exist because everybody's looking for this other and trying to appease or satisfy or they're assuming that in some way, I hope that I will be sort of accepted socially or something.
Right.
There is some social pressure. I mean, like for instance,
no, certainly.
Right. So,
yeah.
So if you go around in your Prius neighborhood with a big gas guzzling SUV that,
yeah,
or God forbid, that needs leaded gas or something, like, right. you're going to be frowned on and gossiped about, right?
For sure.
And
for
so sure. What's the difference between the fantasy of fake other and the social pressure that actually exists?
No, I mean, the social pressure really exists. The point is that there's no, that it exists through our investment in it. Like, you know, like there's no, you know, I think it's easiest to think of, for some reason, my examples always go back to high school because that was the time for the most trauma for me when it was most evident. But, you know, like your example of the, I mean, I wouldn't like to think of the, like, the problem is that if you drive a gas guzzler in the Prius neighborhood, there's a different other that you're performing for other than your, so, but there are certain like free acts where you're like, you know, like say you just say, I'm going to just wear whatever I'm going to wear. And I'm not going to think, so, you know, think about what people are going to say about it. Like then I feel like you, then the other doesn't exist for you. Like the social pressure exists only insofar as you credit it. I think, you know, I mean, you're right that, okay, it has some kind of, you know, tangible existence, but it's only insofar as you credit it that it has an effect on you. So the idea of the other isn't the idea that other doesn't exist isn't that there isn't real social pressure. It's that for the subject, for yourself, that social pressure is if you don't credit it, it has no effect at all. Like it can't deter, you know, it only has power over you insofar as you let it have power over you. And collectively that we do that. I mean, that's the other point, of course, is that collectively we invest this other with a kind of with existence or with power over us. Mm. So,
and you talk a lot about this other as kind of the replacement God, the secular God.
Yeah.
Of the age or something like that. And you talked about like there was a historic shift. Do you think you could go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd love to go into that. So, I mean, you know, I think I talk about this in terms of Adam Smith and this notion of the invisible hand of the market and the way in which that functions. And it's funny because these a lot of like Friedrich Hayek, a lot of pro-capitalist theorists even admit this, that the market determines where, you know, it determines where you should get a, like, if you think about what occupation you should go into, you don't just think about what you want to do, right? You think about, oh, what can I get a job? Where are people hiring? You know, you think about where you're going to live. You think, oh, where's a place where I can get a job? And so there's this way in which that's the other kind of functioning as in the way that God historically did. And so I one of the things that I'm tracing in the book is the way in which capitalism kind of replaces the traditional notion of God and gives us a new, I mean, obviously there are still people that believe in God within capital, you know, in the traditional God within capitalism, but in the way that they live their lives, it's as if capital functions as the God for them, you know, like it sort of guides them in the way that the traditional God guided people in traditional societies. It guides them to what they're going to work, where they're going to live, all these kinds of questions, you know, where they're going to invest their money too. That's a big thing, right? Like we're thinking God tells us, God in the form of like the invisible hand tells us where to invest our money. And we hope that we invest wisely.
It's really fascinating. And then it's more of a, this God, this secular God, is harder to predict too.
Right. I mean, that's true. It's sort of much more like the other God you knew, right? Like you violate the commandments, you don't love your neighbor, blah, 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 blah. And then you've sinned. But here the sin is, I think it's much less. And I think that's one, again, I think you would think that would make the capitalist hold on us a little less, you know, tenacious. But I think it actually makes it more so because you're never really sure what, if you're doing the right thing. You know, I mean, I have no idea. I've never even checked my retirement money because I don't want to even know what the situation is, because I feel so like, oh my God, did I put it in the right thing or did I not? Or what, you know, so. I think that's a way it has a hold over you. You know, you're never quite sure if you are doing the right thing. Are you maximizing how much you could make? Are you really enjoying yourself as much as you should? I mean, that's one of our kind of divine imperatives today, I think, under capitalism, to really maximize how much we enjoy ourselves.
It's really funny too, because if this God, this capitalism, will make you more anxious because it's less predictable, that could make you consume more, right?
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. Right,
It's great. So maybe you will be anxious and you need a pack of cigarettes then, or maybe some booze, or then you
Right, well, you need both things, right? First you need cigarettes, then you need the patch to correct them. First you get a six pack, then you need the counselor to help you work about on your alcohol addiction. Like you
right.
like you get both sides, right?
Yeah. And you talk about that overproduction, so it's like a growth model too. Like capitalism can't have anything but growth and accumulation to work. So then you have too much, and then you have a crisis.
Right. I think to me this is one of the most fascinating things about capitalism in the like in the history of humanity. There have always been like dinosaurs had a crisis, a meteorite hit the planet, and then they were destroyed, right? And like in the history of humanity, there have been crises, like there have been famines, there have been, but under capitalism, the notion of crisis completely changed. It changes. It becomes a crisis of having too much, not enough. I remember 2008, I was going for a run past the local Ford dealership, and there were all these cars, and there was no one on the lot, you know, and like no one to buy them. And I thought, oh my God, like there's going to be, this is just what it's going to, I mean, you know, we came out of the crisis and everything was back to being horrible. But I thought, oh my God, they're just going to have all these and there no one's going to buy them, you know? So I think that's what's, and, you know, the housing bubble, it's interesting how they even, people even talk about it, the bubble, you know, like it's, there's too much housing, you know, and which that causes the crisis because what happens is, and it, again, this touches on the God thing, like people, and then right now, I think even with the stock market pretty high under Trump, people are worried, are investors going to lose faith? They even talk about that, you know, so it's like, and once people lose faith, then the bubble collapses.
Right. Consumer confidence.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's funny too, because you, I was just talking about this with my husband, and I was saying, when I was growing up, there were department stores and things like that, but there weren't super Walmarts and there weren't enormous distribution centers to get every last, you know, quarter penny per ton of crap, you know, with these huge distribution centers and logistics all figured out to maximize profit. So now that you have like a Dollar General every three stores or something, and then there can be no mom and pop store that opens up because there's no way they could compete with a Dollar General or something.
Right, right.
And that means that capitalism will, I mean, it's tricky because then you have, well, everybody can afford to shop at the Dollar General, but nobody can afford to open a business to on their own to make their own way because it squeezed everybody out. And so it's like an all consuming, it winds up consuming everything in its path because everybody gets squeezed on the low end. And it's so as you were writing about this and as you're, you know, noting all these things and you're noting it from the psychic cost side, you're thinking about, you know, what are some of the things we can do we're caught in this thing, but what are some of the things we can do to make it, to alleviate some of it or to do better?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know how.
Aside from a bloody revolution, or
yeah, no, I'm sort of against violence, but
yeah, hopefully.
I'm a pretty firm believer in the, you know, like the watchwords of the French Revolution, like liberté, égalité, fraternité. Like I feel like, and I feel like the middle word, equality, is like totally been forgotten. So I feel like, you know, struggles for equality, I think, are important. I also feel like that one of the most important things we can do is sort of reinforce the public sphere and the notion of something held in common, you know, that we're not first of all. And I think this maybe is the biggest shift. I think that I don't know how this necessarily manifests itself politically, which I think is the interest of your question. But I do feel like we have to think of ourselves as attached to the public, not just isolated monads. as subjects, and that I think that's important. But I also think like just disinvesting in consumption so that be ready to create a sense of equal, it's a community of equality. I do also think that you know, like the struggle for healthcare, I think, or like healthcare for all, seems like a one way that gets manifests itself that comes sort of cuts against the what you're calling the, which I agree with, the capitalization of everything. Like I feel like that's one thing, because how healthcare seems like to me one thing that can't be put in this system of profit and loss, because you know it's just. You know, it's not an investment. It's like people are just trying to stay healthy and survive.
Mm-hmm. But is there a way to do that from the ground up, do you think? Like from people who are in healthcare deciding amongst themselves in a pool to form something? Like, I just wonder, it just seems like the more, it's like a lot of cooks in the kitchen, you know, I always wonder, like, you know, everybody has their opinions and then nothing gets done kind of.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't have a lot of faith in ground up, frankly. Like, I feel like,
yeah, I don't know, I'm but
a supporter of, I mean, you know, I'm from Vermont, so I kind of had to, but of Bernie. And I feel like, you know, I feel like it, and, you know, I feel like it has to be kind of a state levels, you know, changes on the level of the state. I feel like a lot of times people try these alternative things sort of within, like, you know, like the local movement, for instance. Like I'm not against it, obviously, whatever, it's great. But it ends up like just like you were talking about the music festival, it ends up kind of fitting within the capitalist system rather than. Mm-hmm. You know, doing it envisions itself as maybe a challenge to it, but then it kind of just fits in. So I think the changes have to be made. You know, the struggle is on the level of the state. Even I feel like I'm pretty convinced about that.
So you're thinking that the capitalist system has to be changed at the top.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, like one thing I feel like, you know, like. This notion of the public option for health, I'm just using healthcare as an example, but you know, like what if there was this is a crazy idea. And I'm sure every economist would say that this is just totally bizarre, but what if there was like a public option for air travel, for car purchase, you know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like just one version where they're not trying to make a profit, like a public option for candy bars and a public, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, except the Amtrak is, I mean, yeah, I guess, but Amtrak is an interesting case, right? So like we all know that they're publicly subsidized, right? But it costs more. I was talking to a friend of mine, it costs more for him to take three times as much to take a Amtrak from Baltimore to New York than to fly. Now, why is that? And why does it? It's not because airline travel is private and Amtrak is public. It's because we don't recognize all the ways in which we subsidize air travel. You know, like we pay for airports, we pay for, you know, all these air traffic control, like all these things that are TSA, all these things that we pay for. And like car travel, same thing. We think like, oh, it's cheap to drive my car, blah, 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 someplace. But, you know, like, that whole system is already subsidized by this massive road structure.
Mm-hmm. There's other ways it's already included, folded in ahead of time.
Public. And so I guess part of the shift, I think, is to recognize the way in which things that we think of as private are actually already like totally immersed in the public and the common. Mm-hmm. Like you drive your car down the road, it's not a private act. You're like already interacting with this massive state structure that's spent, you know, public money to allow you to do that.
Well, but in terms of your book,
yeah,
and individuals reading it, yeah, and individuals thinking about how they want to interact with capitalism,
yeah,
on an individual level, not I'm going to be the next, you know, I'm going to run in 2020 with the campaign hindsight is 2020. you know, and change things from the top down. They're just going to encounter life as a regular consumer or whatever. So what do you suggest, that how do people approach capitalism in a different sort of way that would make the psychic cost less?
Well, I mean, I think I'm not sure how, I mean, part of my point in my book is like, this is the psychic cost of capitalism and that sucks. But I would say that, I think it's impossible. That's a funny slip. I think it's possible to divest yourself from the notion of that the commodity can provide something for you, like that there's some kind of, I mean, to me, this is the great the way capitalism has its power over us, is that it creates an allure, you know, through advertising or whatever, to the economy and to accumulation. So I think, you know, one thing you can do is just stop believing in the, I mean, like, I really don't believe in the commodity. Like, they mean nothing to me. And I think also in terms of accumulation, like, you know, we think like, oh my God, I got to get a raise, I got to save money. I mean, like, I just think obviously if you're living in poverty, you got to try to get out of poverty. But I think for people, most people in the middle sort of section, like, I don't know, I just feel like, you know, accumulation is a real, that's the main capitalist trap. I mean, that Marx was pretty clear about that. I think that, you know, once you're invested in this idea of accumulation, you're gone psychically.
Mm. Well, with that being said, why are you selling your book? Why isn't it in the public domain?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not making any money on it. I mean, it's just hoping.
It's more of a textbook.
Well, no, it's not a textbook, but I mean, maybe it's a textbook for classes. Mm-hmm. Maybe someone would use it, but yeah, I'm not making any money.
But that you're dodging the point, Todd.
why is it not in the public domain?
Yeah. I mean, your idea.
I hope people will read it. Mm-hmm. I hope people will read it. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, like, books that come out, like Columbia does a good job of marketing the book, mm-hmm. and, like, if I just like put the book up on the whatever internet and just said, here's my thing, like Kevin Spacey and Seven, I have all these like notebooks of like thing. I mean, then I think no one would pay attention to it. And so, I mean, I think part of the way to I do believe that ideas should be vetted. So I, you know, like, and you know, it went to the, I sent to the press, they sent it to readers who said, oh, okay, it's all right, it's not, and, you know, and so I sort of, I believe in that process. I don't think, you know, in some sense, I feel like the sort of massive availability of everything on the internet is kind of a bad thing, because it levels, I mean, I almost would think that's more part of the capitalist process than publishing a book, because it's a leveling out of everything. Mm. Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely not making anything on it, so, you know.
Yeah. Well, for people who are interested in reading it, what would you say is it some of its greatest points? Like, what would you hope that it leaves its legacy? Like, I guess I'm gonna have to edit this out, because I'm getting all tang tungled and my Merg's words wixed.
What's the takeaway? So the takeaway is, that's okay. I'd be loath to talk about what the greatest point of it is, but I would just say the takeaway is this, that capitalism, on the one that it proffers, it tries to sell us dissatisfaction with the promise of some ever greater satisfaction just around the corner. And that, I think that's a promise that we should try to disinvest ourselves in, to resist. So that would be in a sentence, that would be what I think is going on.
Yeah, it's a fantasy, and it's a fantasy that it's very insidious, because you keep playing into it and playing into it, thinking that it's real and thinking it's going to get you somewhere.
Right. And then you can't, I think you fail to recognize the satisfaction you have with your own existence, and that's pretty sad, I think, you know. So I mean, look, I fall for it as much as the next person. So it's, in a way, it's a kind of a self, you know, like a self-help book for myself as well.
Yeah, sure. Well, do you think that the most satisfying, like to you, what are the most satisfying things in life?
I mean, the proper answer is like playing with my kids and blah, blah.
Not what you're supposed to answer.
No, I like those things fine. But for me, the most satisfying thing in life is like curling up with a nice theory book. And then for all day long. And then afterwards watching a nice French thriller. That would be like, you know, that would be that's the ideal. That's the ideal day for me. But having my kids and my spouse around just kind of in the background, that adds. Yeah.
But they're kind of immaterial things.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, unless the book is material or watching the movie is material, but I don't think they are. Yeah. Yeah. I basically don't have, you know, my clothes are pretty crappy and my, I don't have a lot of things. I have a lot of books. I guess that's material.
But. Yeah, yeah. Although you could maybe get them in some other way. But
I could, except here's the thing. I love to write in them, so I know what I'm...
Yeah.
So it's the problem. You know, you're right. Just get them from the library or read them on internet. But I kind of have to write in them.
You like the convenience of writing in them, although you know that you could probably do a notebook or something, but you actually enjoy the convenience.
Yeah, I just have to have the little argument with the writer.
You can't help it. You're a nerd and you have to just, that's one of the things that you're just going to have to keep, you know, the books.
Well, I'm
totally with you on that one. That's why I don't like Kindle as much, because I don't like the note-taking procedure there that,
yeah, I simply cannot read a book on Kindle. So that, for me, because I have to have the, and so in terms of teaching too, it's, I only teach full books to my students. Cause then I say like, you have to bring your book marked up to class so they can never sell it back. So it's a real, that's a disservice maybe, but I'm such a firm believer in that process of, you know, writing in the book.
Well, I think it gets into your long-term memory a little better that way. But then again, I'm a little bit old school that way too.
Yeah, I know. I'm an old person, so I didn't grow up with Kindle, so that's. Although I have to say, my students who are, you know, they're in their, you know, in whatever late teens and 20s, and they all are happy that I assign actual books that they can read, and they prefer them. So maybe there's future.
Yeah, well, I interview so many people and I read so much, but most of the time it's quickly to prepare, and I'll have someone send me just out of convenience send me electronic book or something, and I don't prefer it, but I'm kind of stuck with that usually.
And
I'll have a notebook and I'll write things down, but it doesn't stay in my head like a regular book does.
Right. I don't think it can. Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm stuck with. But, you know, to me, it's better than nothing. But at the same time, I'm much more of a, I like to flip back to the other pages and then refer back and forth. And for whatever reason, it just doesn't, it's not organic enough. And so I can see why, even though the younger students are doing that vintage thing with the books, that there's something more tangible and substantial that you can, you know, even though they're used to the electronic books, there's something else going on there that's tactile that they might appreciate more.
Yeah, I feel like there's something, I do, just to come back to our capitalist discussion, I almost feel like there's something anti-capitalist about the actual, but even though, of course, it's made in a capitalist production system, blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't, like, when you're looking things on screen, you're constantly tempted to look down, check your email, do the other thing, you know, like search the net and like that, internet isn't it like totally the logic of capital, like just transplanted into this new region. Like you're constantly looking for the next, you know, even that term clickbait, you know, like you're looking for the next thing that's going to be even better than the thing that you're on right now. And then, but, and yet you're at the end, you're kind of like, what did I even get out of that hole?
Yeah, what was I even doing a second ago?
Yeah,
And then here's a notification, and then here's a notification, and I've had to turn all that off. And when I'm actually trying to do something, because there's no rest for my brain to actually
dig into
anything.
No, right. I feel like that is. I feel like so many of these critiques of capitalism, blah blah blah, like as an economic system, if you don't really we're sort of stuck in it, so you have to sort of get your bearings within it without just saying, oh, it's terrible. But the other thing is, I think unless you understand what's happening psychically, then you're never gonna, then whatever else we propose is gonna be still burdened with the same problems, you know. Like, to me, that's the great horror of 20th century communism, was in a certain sense, it was still burdened by the same problem, and thus didn't, it wasn't really an alternative at all.
Yeah, well, it's like in the sense of, if communism takes over, then you still have the black market, right?
Right.
And so that, isn't that kind of the same thing?
Sure, you know, it's like, the same thing, but also, yeah. Like, isn't the communist dream, like the dream that informed 20th century communism, was we could have just this society of total abundance without any without any lack, without any suffering, without any, you know, unfulfilled desire, when you know, in fact, unfulfilled desire, that's sort of what we are.
Yeah.
And so that dream was a bad dream in the first place. So
right,
I feel like that, so in that sense, I feel like the alternative or at least the 20th century alternative was actually complicit in the very capitalist system that it was trying to oppose.
Mm. Well, how familiar are you with Peter Rollins' work in Pyrotheology?
I know Peter Rollins. I mean, I don't know him personally, but I know of him.
Yeah, because he always talks about, he's a very interesting guy, and talking about lacking the lack, but we need, people need. And that's what he talks about pyrotheology in the sense of, like, let's blow up what we have, in a way. I mean, it's obviously like gets people upset,
right.
but in a really healthy way. And so he says, you know, he's Irish, so he's a little, you know, he's a little gloomy, but that's, but that's actually the whole point. Is a kind
that's
of
the whole point, right?
Yeah, he's saying he lives in LA because he says there isn't any other place that needs more spiritual healing than LA, because LA is trying to sell you something for whatever's wrong with you, no matter what it is. So, you know, it doesn't have, it could be a Jesus pill. It could be Botox. It could be, you know, you could get to be famous, whatever it is. It's trying to sell you.
Yeah,
it could be what?
La La Land.
Yeah, right. So the whole point is that you need something, and we'll sell it to you, and you'll feel better soon. And he's saying, no, we have to realize there is no feeling better, but that's okay, because once you realize that, then you can feel better knowing you're not going to feel better.
No, I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's actually, and I think Alain de Botton is sort of in that mix too. You know, he's atheist, and he is, I think it was the most, I'll have to link to this in the show notes, but the most read article in the New York Times last year was Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person. And it's a fantastic article just about these same sorts of things, dissatisfaction, and that you are supposed to be dissatisfied. And if you happen to meet somebody who 20% of the time kind of gets you, you are super lucky.
Yeah.
And how lucky you are, and that you can't even possibly know yourself. So how in the world are you expecting someone to know you, and then you're feeling upset about this? Like, it's just so funny.
That's absolutely great. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's right. Like, why do I think that being miserable is like a problem? Isn't that just regular? You know? So I appreciate people who are a little more like, I mean, that's really anti-capitalist.
I feel like that is absolutely true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true.
I think it's like, kind of like, you know, you have to ruin the fantasy so you can actually wake up and live.
Right.
And I appreciate some people shattering some of those sillinesses, because that's for children, really. Like, we have to, and we can, when you stop pretending you're a child, you can actually have fun as if you were.
That's brilliant. I really love that formulation, actually. You should write that down. I do think, though, that I just want to say one little slight, thing on behalf of fantasy. Like, I feel like sometimes, like, even if we really examine how fantasy functions, like, fantasy, the enjoyment that we get in, say, the typical Hollywood fantasy, the enjoyment comes actually from, like, fantasy stages some kind of loss for us. And then, of course, at the end, we get this, we sort of get what we've lost, right? But the enjoyment comes from the fact that it stages this loss for us that we otherwise wouldn't experience. So if we, I almost want to say, yeah, fantasy is a problem. But if we look at fantasy the right way, we'd see that what you're describing actually is at work even within our fantasies. You know, you can't think of a film where you just get the object, right? Like, of course, you have to go through the, like, what's funny about, what's good about, say, I don't know, what's a film I've ever seen, like Groundhog Day, isn't that, oh, he just ends up with Andy McDowell, Bill Murray. It's that they go, he goes through all these different failed attempts to sort of work out the day, you know? So I think, and that's where the enjoyment or satisfaction lies.
Well, would you say then that fantasy, experiencing fantasy unawares is really the problem? It's not just fantasy itself.
That's exactly what I was
saying. Yeah, right. So that's what I'm saying. Is that you're not enjoying fantasy as fantasy is totally fine. It's this, that you're caught up in fantasy that you think is real. That's the problem.
Well, you think that you feel like I'm going to get something. I mean,
yes.
Like, that's the thing.
Yes.
Like, I feel like, and that's where I think capitalism, you know, fits in with the way that, fantasy functions. Like that you feel like you're going to get something that's more than, or that's going to fill in this lack that you have. And that's mm-hmm. impossible. Right. And
right,
so,
right.
And so, yeah.
And capitalism is sort of, it's also based on the fallacy that it's an even trade, but it's never even. There's always
right.
an imbalance.
Right, exactly.
And I think that's a really excellent point, because the labor put in is never what's gotten out, and whatever sacrifice is put in is more than what will be gotten out in the end, too.
Right. I mean, we didn't talk about this, so I don't want to
go right ahead.
But I feel like my favorite part of the book is this notion that what we enjoy in a commodity is actually the sacrifice that goes into the, even though we don't avow it, the sacrifice of the worker that goes into making the commodity, you know, or the sacrifice that we make to purchase the commodity, which is why it's, you know, that, which is why it's more fun to buy something that's more expensive than something that's cheaper, no matter what its use is for us.
And do you think that would be more satisfying than to save up for something to purchase it than to buy it on a credit card?
Now, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I feel like the credit card, is your point that the credit card is more satisfying?
Is not more satisfying.
It's not. I agree. That there's something much more satisfying about saving up and then sacrificing all this money and all this time that you've spent to accumulate that money, you
because
know?
It kind of hurts to
right.
buy it. Yeah, you know, it's funny too, because we're living in a time where, I'm sure you've noticed this too, I think this has to be related to capitalism not losing enough, in a sense, is that, have you noticed people like doing these crazy like Tough Mudder runs and like unnecessary
yeah.
suffering, in a sense, and you're like, what?
Absolutely.
And it's,
well,
like,
I mean, to me, I really think there's very little difference between that and like these radical fundamentalists. Like, I think they're totally of a piece, and totally both. Just, they're not like holdovers of the past. They're a response to the contemporary capitalist universe. You know, like, that's what fundamentalism is. It's like, you know, I'd say in the book, like, it's akin to like bungee jumping or these like incredible mutter runs or whatever, you know, like, I think you're right. Like, they're a way of reintroducing this like incredible sacrifice and suffering, making it visible. But, you know, it's still happening in the capitalist universe. We just don't see it, I think. As sacrifice, yeah. I mean, one of the things I talk about is the amount of sacrifice that goes just into a cell phone. You know, like kids mining in the Congo. You know, it's just incredible. I mean, you know, it's like, like this latest strike we had on Syria for the use of chemical weapons. Like, why didn't we shoot Tomahawk missiles at Apple for using child workers in the Congo who are suffering as much or more than those kids in Syria?
Or take the Syrian refugees instead of dropping a $317 million bomb on
the
area.
Of course. I mean, it's mind-boggling, right? Yeah.
But this has been really enjoyable. I am appreciative of your time, Todd, and hopefully you can give people ways to reach you to explore some of these ideas a little bit more.
Sure. If anyone wants to contact me, my email is todd.mcgowan@uvm.edu. I teach at the University of Vermont, so you can find me that way.
Yeah. And your last name is spelled
M-C. No, sorry. You want to do it?
M-C-G-O-W-A-N.
Correct. I also have there's also a page on this, if you know this site, academia.edu, that has some different papers and stuff. I think actually a couple chapters of Capitalism and Desire are on there.
Yeah. The neat thing about your work in particular that I really enjoyed isn't, it's not your typical arguments decrying capitalism. It's the piece that talks about the psychic cost that's so interesting to me. And I think a lot of other people too. It's not just like, you know, the evils of capitalism bad. Because, yeah. You know, there's only so much you can do when you're caught in a capitalist culture, but when you can understand the toll that it's taking on your regular life and the people around you, and take a step back a little bit and count those costs, then you can make some changes in your regular life and how you encounter those things and how you want to respond and react to your world. I think that's actually a really useful part.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. It's interesting that the subtitle of the book, Psychic Costs of Free Markets, it wasn't mine. It was the editor at Columbia. They were really dissatisfied with the subtitle I gave them. And so they kept coming up with these other ones and no one could get it. And then the editor one night, she said, I was in bed asleep. And then it just came to me as I woke up. And so her name is Wendy Lochner. And so I was very, I thought it was really great. Like, it really kind of captured what I was trying to get at, but I didn't come up with it.
So. Yeah, it does encapsulate the crux of what everything's driving at, because that's the problem that's so irritating that you can't get down to. Because I think once you say what's going on, people are like, oh, that's it. That's what it is. That's what's driving me insane.
Right.
It's important for us to know this pool that we're swimming in and why it's so freaking irritating and gets us nowhere. Yeah. All right. Let's keep in touch. Thank you so much, Todd.
Okay. Thanks, Lisa. I really appreciate it.
Spark My Muse listeners, I'm Josef from Sweden. I'm the curator of the podcast The Catacombic Machine. I'm a big fan of Lisa and the work she's doing with Spark My Muse, and I just want to encourage you guys to go and support her over at patreon.com. Thank you.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes, too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.